This is Leader ReadyCast, a monthly podcast featuring real-world lessons, best practices, and action-oriented insights for the you're-it moments when you're called upon to lead. Leader ReadyCast is the official podcast of the National Preparedness Leadership Initiative, a joint program of the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health and the Center for Public Leadership at the Harvard John F. Kennedy School of Government. Subscribe to Leader ReadyCast wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Hi, I'm Eric McNulty, and welcome to the latest episode of Leader ReadyCast. Who are the first responders? Often they are not the professionals. They are the people closest to the incident, bystanders. In the opinion of my guest today, Brad Newbury, these spontaneous volunteers are an overlooked and often underutilized asset in an emergency. As we'll learn from Brad, these ordinary people can save lives. FEMA has spread the idea of thinking of the whole of the community. I've written about our current age as presenting such a multiplicity of threats that we cannot rely solely on professional responders. There's just too many of them. There simply isn't the capacity in the system to respond to everything. Newbury's efforts are consistent with this thinking. He provides pragmatic, tangible steps that can leverage the skills and willingness of citizens to step up when it matters most. Brad Newbury is a captain and paramedic in the Stoughton Fire Department in Stoughton, Massachusetts, and the president and CEO at the National Medical Education and Training Center. Most relevant to our conversation today is that Brad is the driving force behind Who Can Help, an initiative to train professional responders to better utilize civilian assets. Brad, welcome to Leader ReadyCast.
Thank you so much, Eric, and I really appreciate you giving me this opportunity to speak to your audience today.
Well, I thank you for all your work. I think it's a really important topic, and you're doing very interesting work that we're going to explore today. Now, tell us about Who Can Help. How did it start, and where is it now?
Who Can Help was built as part of a meta-leadership project in Cohort 17 at the MPLI. Our team developed a program to be taught to the professional responders. Those are the police, fire, EMS, Coast Guard, Park Service, anyone who might be responding as the legally responsible responder to a mass casualty incident. The course teaches a simple protocol where professional responders can use and leverage those volunteers who are already helping when we arrive at the scene, and those who are present or maybe willing to help. We teach responders how to build a team of volunteers quickly, assign appropriate tasks, lead that team, communicate and network within the team, and then demobilize that team when enough professional rescuers and responders have arrived at the scene. You know, when I think about how it started is, I also serve as the Associate Director of EMS for the Disaster Medicine Fellowship at the Beth Israel Hospital. We educate and train an international group of physicians and nurses in disaster medicine and disaster response. During my tenure at the fellowship, we have studied many disasters. I began to see a trend across major events. Bystanders, who we call spontaneous volunteers, were helping victims prior to arrival of professional responders. These are people that were either part of the event in some way, or they were in the proximity of the event and they stepped up to help those in need. It's interesting to see how in many mass gatherings, you will find in the crowd off-duty professional rescuers, firefighters, police officers, EMS professionals, doctors, nurses, members of the military who are already helping when we get there. I believe inherently that most people are good folks and during a crisis, they want to help. Since this was happening organically, I began to think about how do we train professional responders to deal with those bystanders when we respond to mass casualty incidents? See, professional responders who are first to arrive at those mass casualty incidents face a complex and potentially overwhelming challenge. Even in a well-coordinated response, the professional responders may not be able to treat all the injured at the same time. They must triage and prioritize the victims, and spontaneous volunteers often heroically step in to fill that gap without even being asked. But their courage and commitment can often add complexity to an already chaotic and challenging situation. We needed to change the way that we as professional responders think about those that are willing to help. So, you know, where is our project now? We've published our research and the protocol in industry professional journals for both fire and EMS services. We've presented the program at several professional fire and EMS and disaster conferences, both domestically here in the United States and internationally. And the goal from the beginning of the project was to develop the program and give it to FEMA so that they could fund it and socialize it to a much larger audience. See, FEMA has been engaging volunteers in a number of ways during disaster, including some major initiatives in their Stop the Bleed campaign and You Are the Help Until Help Arrives. However, we've been training the general public to help, but no one thought about what happens when the professional responders show up and how are they trained to interact with those that we just trained to stop the bleed. You know, as a firefighter paramedic for more than 30 years, I've been to a number of MCIs in my career. I've seen spontaneous volunteers helping others when we arrive, only to watch the police usher those helpers away, or even sometimes our own folks from our service demanding that they leave the scene, despite not having enough resources to triage all the victims.
You know, it's interesting as you say that, because it is looking at how we've seem to have created two opposing forces here. On the one hand, training the public to help. On the other hand, training the professionals to clear the scene and tell the help to go away. So it seems like to me, you know, in meta leadership terms, your program is an exercise in leading across to the various agencies who are responding and then beyond to the various stakeholder communities. So instead of these two forces being in opposition, they actually can come together and integrate and be on the same side, looking toward the same objective. So what leadership lessons have you learned as you've gone out and begun to present this and share it with different organizations?
Well, when I look back at the journey, a number of lessons stand out. First was me, the person, as that meta leader. I had an incredible team of other meta leaders in their cells. You know, these are folks leading at some of the highest levels of their profession. And to be frank, it was humbling for me to have an opportunity to lead that team. You know, we had an admiral on our team, a prominent international physician, a high-level leader from OEM in New York City, a police chief, one of our amazing team members was a former military officer and now serving at NORAD. We had a provincial emergency manager from Canada, a ranked officer from the Mass State Police, a police chief, and myself. You know, I had to be grounded in how I saw myself as a leader and really be self-aware and use the tools and education that I gained at the NPLI to lead this team through the project. Another lesson that, you know, that when I look back was how we gained clarity on the situation. We had to really understand the problem and find solutions to that problem. Our team began by defining the problem. And I thought, you know, I had the definition pretty well, but this, you know, over the years I had thought about this a lot, but I also knew that I was biased in how I saw the problem. I had to let the perspective of the team develop their understanding of the problem had to really develop. During those meetings, I watched and listened more than I spoke. The team began to develop a real framework in how we're going to engage key stakeholders. I realized quickly that the depth and breadth of the project was expanding well beyond what I had been thinking about in the past. We developed a study to socialize to professional responders. The goal was to understand if responders had seen volunteers helping, did they engage them? Did they ask them to leave the scene? Did they believe there was value in asking them to help in the incident? We also asked them what they believed we could ask a volunteer to do at the scene. What should we never ask them to do? And then we sent this out to several thousand professional responders. We had a robust return of that survey, and that was remarkable. It helped us develop the future curriculum for this project. We wrote a white paper with the information we had gained and created a vision for the future. And I think once we had developed the program and the white paper, the next steps were using what we had learned about connectivity at the NPLI. We had to connect our project to the community of stakeholders. And we started reaching out to first fire and EMS professional journals. We're able to get articles published in Fire Engineering Magazine and the Journal of Emergency Medical Services. And at the same time, we began to engage response services. One of the lessons here was our approach. We learned very quickly that even though we saw this as an amazing opportunity, that there were political, professional, and cultural considerations that we hadn't thought about when we began to talk to some of these large organizations. We were able to pivot, though, very quickly in our approach as we socialized our project to other organizations and address some of those issues that we had not thought about right up front.
Well, this is interesting. It's a great growth process. I'm glad to see that you've continued to iterate and incorporate the increased understanding into what you're doing. I want to talk a bit about the resistance you get. Civilian responders, this is not a new topic. I mean, we've known they've played a role from as far back as we can think. I mean, Rebecca Solnit's book, A Paradise Built in Hell, documented major disasters from the San Francisco earthquake through Katrina, and showed how actually it was the community who responded first and often responded very well to that. And more recently, we've seen bystanders, or perhaps we should call them do-standers, or spontaneous volunteers, actually, like your term. They stepped forward in the Boston Marathon bombing response in 2013. They stayed when they could have run away and helped save lives. The Las Vegas shooting in 2017. We had the Cajun Navy and Hurricane Harvey that got famous, a lot of coverage on television also in 2017. So why do you think there's still resistance to incorporating those on-site civilians into response planning?
Well, I think one of the problems is that the current training for professional responders focuses on reducing the complexity of the response to the MCI by clearing the scene of those spontaneous volunteers and bystanders. This approach does not recognize the reality of those spontaneous volunteers, nor does it allow for those professional responders to take advantage of the skills and the potential support that those spontaneous volunteers can provide. And when I was trying to build the Who Can Help team at the MPLI, one of the first people to join my team was Captain Mike Liver from the Mass State Police. Captain Liver recognized right away that the training he was given as a young trooper, and also the training that he was teaching to other troopers, was flawed in some way. And he knew that he had to be a part of the change. So the resistance really comes from our training. And until we create a paradigm shift in the way that we train responders to MCIs, this is going to continue to happen and cause resistance.
So once again, inertia is the greatest enemy, it seems. Not a logical argument against it, but just the inertia of existing training programs. I know those are very hard to change. But so with that, where have you seen success? What gets response agencies on board with this approach?
You know, every time I've delivered the program, I get to a point in the program where I put up a slide and there's our slogan with our Who Can Help, and there's a raised hand picture. And I see the expression on faces in the audience begin to change, like an epiphany just took place. Some will turn to their fellow students, they'll begin to wave. That is the successful moment. That moment when we create that paradigm shift in that person, and they realize that we have been doing it wrong. You know, after presenting the program at the EMS World Conference just recently in October, I had a number of people request the information for the presentation, and for several have invited me to come to their agency and present the information to their. You know, before the pandemic, we had trained the recruit class in the Mass State Police, and you know, that came about because of the experiences of senior leaders being on the street, on the highway, where they were alone and came upon a multi-car accident, a bus accident, or a van rollover, and where they were overwhelmed with the totality of patients that needed help, and other professional responders were several minutes away. Simple tasks done by spontaneous volunteers can save lives, and they saw the real value in that. And that's how we had to approach those agencies.
Well, I hope we see more requests of that information after people listen to this broadcast. You know, I know one of the things we need to think about, and you mentioned this to me when we talked a few days ago, is that when people do step forward, we can't forget about them after the event. You know, so what kind of after event support do we need to provide for those spontaneous volunteers, and how should we integrate that into plans?
Well, part of the teaching that we do with the Who Can Help program is demobilization of those that have helped. When the incident is stabilized and there are enough professional responders on scene, this is the time to gather those volunteers, capture their information, their name, their address, phone number, email, say thank you for their help. We need to also check on them in the coming days. You know, one thing that really struck me was when I was studying the Boston Marathon bombing was the amount of blood that those that were helping the victims had on them. The amount of blood that was on the sidewalk, and the visual horror of some of the injuries those victims suffered. You know, I thought about that person who just stepped up to help, who were not us, meaning they weren't professional responders. They had no time to build resiliency from a mental health standpoint. They didn't have years of responding to difficult calls and situations to build that resiliency. because you have to go through hard things sometimes to build resiliency. This would be a defining moment for some of these volunteers in their lives. I think we owed it to them to support them physically, emotionally. We need to ensure that they're seen by healthcare professionals if they've had a bloodborne pathogen exposure. We need to facilitate mental health counseling to reach out, check on them. And we may want to gather them later on and celebrate them for helping as a team.
Yeah, I think that's so interesting because you're right. In listening to this whole story that you're telling today, we seem to be approaching this piecemeal. So we think about, okay, you know, FEMA's thinking, get people ready with Stop the Bleed and other programs to be able to help, but we don't then transfer that into the training of EMTs and police and others to be able to be ready to help, to deal with those folks. And then we don't think it all the way through to once it's done, what do we do? Because the professional responders will get those kind of support services, or so we hope. And we need to be able to, again, think through. So it's integrating into this full cycle of planning, response, and recovery that seems to be where we need to go. Would you agree with that?
I absolutely agree with that, Eric. I think it's important that we do, you know, continue to look at those folks that are showing, they're going to be there. And we're going to have to make them part of that recovery process.
Absolutely. You know, and I think in terms of preparedness, you mentioned you have many people out there, doctors, nurses, military, others who have made some training. I always like to put a plug in. So those who are listening to this episode, it would be great if more organizations offered basic first aid training, CPR, those kinds of training services to their employee base as a community service, right? It's going to better prepare you on the workplace if something happens, but then in the community. So when you're in that baseball stadium or you're on that subway car or on the highway and there's a mass casualty incident, you actually have more people who have the basic skills to be able to do just what Brad's talking about today, about being able to step in and help. And so, you know, again, if we truly think as whole of community, how can we be ready for these major events? And it doesn't have to be an MCI. It could be, a storm, any kind of incident where there are injuries or others who need to be attended to best prepare our communities to be able to respond in a way that makes sense.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more, Eric.
It's so good. Between the two of us, we'll hopefully get some converts out there to be able to offer this. As I say, I think it's one of those things that helps people better engage with each other and helps the organizations engage with their communities. So we'll put that clarion call out there. If people want to learn more about this, where do they go? How do they reach out to be able to get the materials or information about having you deliver the program, or just to learn more about what you've done?
We continue to champion this cause. And I think the project, unfortunately, began to gain momentum, and then the pandemic hit. And now the world's recovering, we're moving forward. Our goal is to gain the attention of major government stakeholders to make the project a national initiative where all professional responders are trained in who can help. And for the listeners, if there's anyone out there in FEMA who's listening, we'd love to speak with you about our program. And I'd be more than happy to interact with other listeners and speak specifically about how they can help and join our cause. You know, we set up an email to reach our team, and that email is whocanhelp@nmetc.com. So I don't know if we can put that out there in the show notes, Eric, but it's certainly a way to get a hold of us. And, you know, I really like to just take a moment and thank our team. I had Tim Fox, Anita Shore, Shane Shriver, Mike Kent, Mike Liver, Anthony Voigt, Dr. Mubarak. Their tireless work ethic and on this project and they really move the needle. We would not be where we are today without their efforts.
Well, great. And it is clearly a team effort. And obviously that has paid off with all that and the continued enthusiasm. And I think that it's great for us at the NPLI to hear about stories like this, because we always hope that the projects people embark on for 6 months when they're in the residential program at Harvard, that they do something significant within that 6 months, but then some projects like this one continue on beyond that 6-month period and really begin to make an impact on the ground out there where it matters most. in communities in the midst of adversity, helping people step up and make a positive difference. So thank you for carrying this forward. And I thank you to all the team members for continuing to stay involved and contributing to this effort.
Thank you so much, Eric. It's been my pleasure to be involved in this project, to be involved with the MPLI. And I look forward to where this project can continue to go. And we hope that we change and create that paradigm shift within the professional responder organizations, and that this becomes the future curriculum for every responder out there.
Well, thank you. And, you know, when we look around, I know whenever I'm in a crowded space, I always think, if something happens, where will I go? What will I do? And what help can I provide? And I think what we've learned this morning is that we all can help. We all have something we can contribute in the event of an adverse incident. And here's hoping that we can continue to see a paradigm shift toward making the best use of spontaneous volunteers during these incidents, that we can incorporate it into more and more training for the professionals so they know how to work best with those folks. And we can train more civilians to have some basic skills so that they too will know what to do, because it could be a family member, it could be a friend that they have to assist, or it could just be, you know, a stranger they've never met before. But whomever, there is that natural human altruism to want to help. And I think, Brad, thank you so much for what you're doing in terms of being able to systematize that and make sure that we play off and benefit from that altruism, and we don't push it away and push it outside the yellow tape. So thank you so much for joining us today on Leader Ready Cast.
Thank you so much for having me, Eric. It was a pleasure.
This has been another episode of Leader Ready Cast from the National Preparedness Leadership Initiative. Subscribe to Leader Ready Cast wherever you get your favorite podcasts, and find out more about us at npli.sph.harvard.edu. Follow us on Twitter @HarvardNPLI. Thanks for listening, and be ready to lead.